From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. With her breakout novel, Waiting to Exhale, Terry McMillan introduced us to four black professional women waiting for Mr. Right. Then there was the 42-year-old Stella, who got her groove back in Jamaica with a young lover half her age. For millions of readers, Terry McMillan hits a nerve with her warm and thinly veiled autobiographical portrayals of love, friendship, and the grooves and gasping moments of the human condition. Her characters navigate their way through marriage and menopause, motherhood and divorce, with a stubborn will to survive and laugh. Her latest novel, The Interruption of Everything, finds her heroine, a middle-aged mother of three, looking for redemption as her world and marriage come undone. Now the author is ending her own marriage in what has become a very public divorce for the woman who took us to the groove. This hour On Point, best-selling novelist Terry McMillan. You can join the conversation. Are you a Terry McMillan reader? Did you exhale with her? Get your groove back. What is her place in the landscape of American, of African-American novelists? And are you ready now to put your arm around her? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Memphis is Terry McMillan, best-selling author of six novels, including Waiting to Exhale and How Stella Got Her Groove Back. Her new novel is The Interruption of Everything. Terry McMillan, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So here you are, on the road, a new novel out, a whole new story. A lot of readers, a lot of listeners will have read your earlier books. They've sold nearly 10 million copies. Take us to where you are in the evolution of Terry McMillan, how you see the world, what you're drawn to write about now.
Well, that's a big question. If I were to write about everything that I cared about, I'd be a nutcase. right now, I think I'm a bit concerned about, mostly about women in middle age and later years, I think, and how our unhappiness seems to be somewhat profound. I've just been noticing it a lot.
Is it inevitable? Is it something about the way our country, our culture, our moment is put together?
I don't know. I think the media has a lot to do with it. I think, what happens on television and film has a lot to do with how women perceive of them, how they see themselves physically, spiritually, emotionally. And some of our expectations, I think, are lofty and ungrounded and superficial. And I think that we've been caught up in it and to some extent suffer as a result of it.
You've always turned in your books to close friendships between women in this new book, The Interruption of Everything. You've got a group of friends who hold pity parties, which mm-hmm. are not exactly mm-hmm. just woe-is-me parties, but parties they describe as places to talk about all their failings, their frustrations, their shortcomings, and not to be repeaters, you say. It's not good to come back with the same problems again and again, but try and do something about them. Is that a reality of Terry McMillan's life, or is that a dream, an ideal, that kind of circle of friends, that supportive, that buoyant, that open to a person, a writer's own failings?
Well, I have friends that I can talk to like that, but the pity party was kind of a fantasy that I had. I mean, I had a birthday party where I had some of my friends come and we were supposed to choose one thing about ourselves that we would like to change and talk about it. And some of us got to it, and some of us had a few too many glasses of wine. Not me, because I don't drink, but it still turned out okay. I have a lot of friends that I trust, friends that I've had some since college. We don't judge each other, and we trust each other. And it's almost as if they're closer to me in some ways than my sisters,
because
we don't have real lofty expectations of each other,
and not
and
the same
yin
history.
And yin.
Right.
Well, don't really want anything from each other. Mm-hmm. I don't think.
Mm-hmm. And siblings usually need something one way or another from their
They judge you.
Yeah, they judge. They can't help it.
Parents do, too.
Right. There it comes. Terry McMillan, I wish you'd take us a little bit through this story. People know the big lines of your stories in previous novels. In fact, they become kind of frameworks for how we think about life, getting the groove back and waiting to exhale.
Stop.
Well, no, they have. You just listen to Ordinary Conversation. It's there. Give us, in a nutshell, what's going on in The Interruption of Everything? What's the story here?
It's a story about a woman who's perimenopausal. Her husband is going through a midlife crisis. Their children are out of the house in college. And, you know, Marilyn has a few interruptions that she thought, when she thought there was a clearing, that was about to prevail, in that she finds out she's pregnant. There are things that occur with her mother and her foster sister that cause her to have to reevaluate how she had planned to take advantage of the time she now had to herself. That's pretty much it's how she can not forfeit her own pleasure and her own freedom now that it was certainly come up available to her. She was trying to figure out how she could balance things out this time around.
And
just
many complications ensue from that. Not an easy journey. I'd love to get a feeling of this if you do a little bit of reading for us, Terry. There's a reading starting on page 6. And it's quite hilarious where she thinks she's going into menopause. In fact, it turns out, as you say, she is, but she's also headed into pregnancy. She's listening. Marilyn is in a bathroom at a place of work, and she's listening to two colleagues here. Gives us a flavor. Could you read a bit for us?
Oh, sure. But I think what you wanted me to read is the friends that work there.
That's right.
Craft store.
Yeah, yeah.
Trudy and
she's listening to Trudy and Maureen. From she's sitting in a bathroom stall, listening in on a conversation that I thought kind of caught the feeling of the book. I wonder if you could share with us.
He cheated. Maureen blurts out again, as if she's trying to remind herself of it. But don't you worry one bit, because he'll pay for it big time. Trudy says, a little louder. I'm not sure if she's talking about karma, child support, or alimony. But I don't want a divorce, Maureen slurs, which just means the Xanax she's required to take must have kicked in. Now she's crying. I just want things to be back the way they used to be, exactly, precisely like they were, normal. I feel like yelling out to Maureen that nothing can ever be the way it was. We just long for whatever was once good. It's the longing that makes us slide into a nostalgic coma. It's a way of resisting what is happening right now. I loved raising my kids, but I wouldn't want to go through it again. They're finally out of the house and off at college. If the truth be told, I crave the exact opposite of what Maureen wants. To go forward, not backward. I'm just not sure how to get there.
Novelist Terry McMillan reading from her new novel, The Interruption of Everything. I was caught by the line, we long for whatever was once good. You talk about nothing can be the way it was. You yourself have been seen as a kind of forward pusher among American writers, among black American writers. Give us a sense of where you started out in terms of what you wanted to accomplish in your writing and where that stands now.
Well, you know, I never really had aspirations to be a writer. I never really thought about what I wanted to achieve as a writer. It was something that I just sort of stumbled on. I started in college by inadvertently writing a poem about a bad relationship. And it sort of evolved from there into I wrote editorials. I went to UC Berkeley, mm-hmm. and I used to write these scathing editorials because they let me get away with it. And I found it very liberating. And then I took a fiction class from Ishmael Reed and found out you could lie and do the same thing and feel just as good as long as you told the truth through your lies. And, you know, I've always sort of been really frustrated by human behavior. I've seen a lot of tragedy, a lot of things that happened between people that I just did not understand why we behave the way we do. And so I found that fiction writing enabled me to sort of try to at least unravel some of it, not necessarily judge and come up with answers, but just try to help me paint a picture in a manner that I could at least feel some compassion, because I don't get a lot of this that we do to each other. I just don't.
Do you look
and
at
that's
it,
pretty much it, you know,
the cruelty of people one to another, why there's not more compassion there, and Terry McMillan standing in the middle and saying, what's going on here, let's look at how this works.
And not even cruelty, but I mean, I'm walking here in the NPR studios, and there's all this artwork in the hallways that some that people have donated to raise money, and we're talking about how generous people can be, and when you juxtapose people's generosity right next to other people's cruelty, the whole dichotomy to me is just fascinating. I'm like, what happens in between this space? You know, what about this person on this block and this person on this block? Where, it's so much to it, you know, from how we were raised and what our values are, what was instilled in us, what we care about, what we don't respect, all of it.
We're going to come back and look at as much of that as we can dig into with novelist Terry McMillan. Her new novel is The Interruption of Everything. You can join us. What is it that's made Terry McMillan one of the most popular novelists of our time? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
It's just too much. And it hurts like hell. That's the way you feel.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist Terry McMillan, author of Waiting to Exhale and How Stella Got Her Groove Back, about her new book, The Interruption of Everything. You can join our conversation this hour. What about it? Did you exhale with Terry McMillan? Did you get your groove back? Black women, does Terry McMillan speak to you, for you? And all women, do the travails of Terry McMillan's characters track your own? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Talk. Mary is calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
I'd like to know, ask Terry McMillan, where does she see herself in this, the pantheon of black female writers like Morrison, B.B. Morcan, and Alice Walker? And do you see yourself as popular, your work is popular fiction or a so-called literature?
Great question, Mary. Terry McMillan, thanks.
So-called literature, huh? I think of all of our work, at least the writers that you named, I consider my work to be literature. I don't think of it as pop fiction. I think critics have labeled it pop fiction because it's quote-unquote popular. But I see my work pretty much the same in that I tell what I consider to be serious stories, but I have humor imbued in my work, and I use the language that my characters think and speak in. But I don't think that my work is formulaic in that it's predictable, which to me is what sort of constitutes a lot of what you would consider pop fiction. And when I think about Faulkner and Hemingway and Chekhov and Ann Tyler or Eudora Welty and everybody
writes. And Toni Morrison and Alice Walker.
And Toni, but everybody writes in the language that they are familiar with, and that sort of represents their time. And our work, in some cases, represents the time in which we live and the characters who inhabit that time. And I think that that's how I see my work. But in some ways, you are, criticized to some extent. They want to put a label on you when your work is as popular as mine has become. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I just refuse to let them define me. And it's a way to dismiss you as well and to discount the quality of your work. And I'm not saying I'm a great writer, but I don't see my stories as being any less literary than Toni Morrison's, even though I don't write as eloquently and metaphorically and all that as they do. But, you know, all of us have our own voices. Ring Lardner had a voice. J.D. Salinger, and I have a lot of respect for all of them.
Mary, in Iowa City, what do you think?
Well, because I'm a literature major, I think of Terry McMillan's work as more as popular work, but that's just in the progress that literature makes itself. We have a tendency to believe that black people should write about slavery and write about blues and the suffering. Mm-hmm. We're Americans. We write about American stuff. And I saw her on the Tavis Smiley show. She competes with her book. She has a personality.
Yes, and we can hear it right now. Mary, thanks so much for calling. Terry McMillan, speak to that, if you would. You mentioned Ishmael Reed earlier. He's been described as an early mentor of yours, a radical black novelist. And Mary says black American writers don't need to be, shouldn't always be caught in the literature of struggle, in grappling with oppression. What's your sense of that history and where you stand in relation or opposition to it?
Well, I think that almost all of our relationships that we write about in fiction is oppressed. It's about oppression to some extent. You know, I think that what she may be referring to is racial oppression.
Yeah, there's the oppression of the human condition, but racial oppression is something else again, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, that's a double whammy. And I think that's what I thought she was referring to, protest literature and civil rights literature of the 60s. Because almost all writing is about suffering, let's face it.
But
it's
to
what extent.
In the 80s, you became identified with what was called the new black aesthetic, turning its back on the black arts movement of the 60s. Trey Ellis, novelist, sort of at the forefront of defining this. Did you self-define when you set out as getting on a road that would take you to a different place? What was your goal?
No, I said earlier, I didn't have a goal. All I did was I wrote about what was plaguing me at the time. And back in the mid-80s, I noticed that a lot of my girlfriends and I, we had all graduated from universities, and we weren't all, we were somewhat attractive. At least we thought we should be able to get a boyfriend.
Right, at least.
Or maybe a husband.
Right.
A date would have been nice.
Right.
And I looked around, and it was like all these women's magazines, all they talked about was how to get a date, where to find a boyfriend, how to find a husband. And I was thinking, you know what? We haven't had a date in a while, have we? What's wrong with this picture? And I just set out to tell a story about the whole dearth or whatever it was of the lack of men in our lives, and why was this so? And I didn't know if it was us or if it was them. And that was it. It's always a curiosity. It's never an answer. It's just, you know, Chekhov said, man will only become better once you make him see what he is like. And that's what I do in all of my stories. I just question, what are we doing? And what does it say about us as men, as women, as black women and men in this day and age, in the year or whatever in which I'm writing about? That's all.
That's it.
It's not all inclusive, let me tell you.
With that, though, in moving away from protest, writing protest literature, you became identified with an emerging black middle class women in particular. It's interesting to see how that kind of floated on up as your books became enormous sellers, a lot of money poured in, and the settings of your books floated right up beyond the middle class. How great is the autobiographical kernel of your work?
Well, I'll put it this way. I think that a lot too much attention is paid in writing by black writers in our work about our economic situation. There aren't as many poor African Americans as you think. And a lot of us live middle class lifestyles and upper middle class lifestyles. A lot of people that I know, their children go to college. Some of them, they pay for their college education.
Sure.
It's sort of like, you know, I mean, there are a lot of poor white people. And if somebody writes about poor white people, it's considered raw or Southern, you know, it's like Southern writers. It's almost stereotypical that, you know, I don't apologize or try to I don't name drop in my work. You know, everybody doesn't drive Mercedes or Bentleys, and everybody's not wearing Manolo shoes and all that. I don't try to apologize for being middle class or my characters being middle class. In fact, I see it as just being American. They pay their rent and their bills, and they have credit cards just like everybody else. And that's what I think is the difference between the literature of the 60s and now. It's I accept myself and the people around me as being Americans. We are African Americans, and we just happened to be able, we are living on some levels the quote-unquote American dream. You know, we grew up, we became educated like some of our parents had prepped us to do. And, you know, we aren't criminals. We aren't crackheads. There are some, but not all of us. And I choose to write about them. If I chose to write about a crackhead, I will.
So let me ask you about that then. Once you're writing about Americans who happen to be black, who have realized the American dream, is it still different in a fundamental way from a novel built around white central characters? And if so, how?
Say that again. Is it?
You say you're writing about people who have realized in many circumstances the American dream. So does that mean it's the same as writing about anybody else in America? How much remains?
No, because no. Mm-hmm. No. What I'm saying is that I don't have to sit and explain what it means. I'll put it this way. I write from a black perspective. I write with history behind me. Okay. But rather than imbuing my work with that history, I assume most people already know it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That I know what happened during slavery. I know how difficult it has been during the civil rights movement. I know that there are people out here still oppressed, and economically. I know that there is poverty, okay? But it's not that I'm not interested in it. It's not that I'm not concerned about it. But I try to imbue my work with it in a different way without being didactic and without beating you over the head with it. It's in there.
Yeah.
It's in there.
And you make
because
it.
Because you know when you hear the words come out of some of these characters' mouths that they're black, and you can tell where they've come from.
Mm-hmm.
And if they have been abused or pained in some way because of the color of their skin or for any other reason.
I'd love to hear some more from the new novel, The Interruption of Everything. There's a reading blocked out here, kind of in the middle of the book, where indeed things are very personal and the battleground is marriage. I wonder if you could read some of that for us, Terry McMillan. And listeners, you can join us as well at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're with Terry McMillan, author of Waiting to Exhale, How Stella Got Her Groove Back, and The Interruption of Everything. Terry, could you read for us there?
I sure can. I have just made history. This marks the first time I've ever spent the night away from home, alone, in almost a quarter of a century. I pray Leon is freaking out. He should know what it feels like to wonder where I am for once. I wish I could live here, or somewhere that wasn't home, for a month without telling him. I have already taken the rest of the week off from work to be with my son, who isn't around. In fact, maybe I should find some exotic place to go where I can dig up my soul until it rises to the surface. But then what? I order breakfast from room service, orange juice, decaf, eggs Benedict, home fries, eat all of it and read USA Today. The television is waiting to be turned on, and since I'm in a frigging hotel room and don't want to go home yet, I do. Some talk show is on, and I can't believe when seconds before they go to a commercial break, the topic of today's show is splattered across the screen. Can this marriage be saved? The real question should be, is it worth saving? Or ask if they want to save their marriage because it's the marriage they want to hold on to, not the person. As if marriage is some kind of all-encompassing entity that can sustain you all by itself.
Mm. Terry McMillan reading from her new novel, The Interruption of Everything.
I don't remember writing that.
and there it is. And there it is anyway. And, you know, as I read through, I couldn't help but be struck by your line. Your books often seem to play one off the other. References there. You say, maybe I should find some exotic place to go where I can dig up my soul until it rises to the surface. And that is famously what your character Stella appeared to do in How Stella Got Her Groove Back. Do you see the books playing one off the other? Are you being impish with us, having fun here?
No. I'm serious. I don't remember writing this. No. I mean, she was in a hotel room. basically trying to just escape. And I think she was just thinking that maybe this isn't far enough away. But no, I wasn't thinking about old Stella.
If you would, tell us about your personal moment. Your How Stella Got Her Groove Back was written off of your own experience of going to Jamaica, finding love. We read just a month ago, you're now filing divorce from the young man that you met there, claiming he's gay, and things seem really rough. What's happening? What are you learning?
Well, I'm learning that there are some people in the world who can't be trusted. And they deceive you, and they betray you, and they justify it. They are actors, and some of them are very, very good at it. I don't believe that one bad apple spoils the whole tree. I'm not that naive. But I am pretty much just, initially I was hurt, but over the past 8 months, I've been more offended by most of this, because Jonathan has tried, he and his lawyer have tried to make a spectacle of my life. Mm. They've invaded my privacy. They've slandered me, told all kind of lies about my personal behavior, and all in an attempt to get my money. And it's really sad and unfortunate, but as a matter of principle, I just could not acquiesce, and I'm not going to, because I've been too good to this young man over the years, and for him to, after explaining to me, coming out of the closet, mm-hmm. and letting me know after having become a U.S. citizen, and I've basically gone into debt to try to help him, stand on his own two feet, this is like a slap in the face. And I'm just not going to be knocked down by it. And he should be ashamed of himself, but he's not. He's a sociopath, and he needs to be stopped. And more women out here need to be made aware of the fact that, they're lurking out here. And they choose people who are generous and kind and successful. And it's one out of every 25 people are sociopaths. I've studied it. And he has no conscience, and that's why he's able to continue to do what he's doing, because there's no way. And that's one of the things that has sort of outraged me, and why a lot of people don't understand how I have become such a victim. You have to know how these people operate.
But the fascinating thing here, Terry McMillan, is that we feel like we've studied it too. I mean, we know it was fictionalized, but How Stella Got Her Groove Back had so much of autobiography in it.
No, it didn't.
It seems to. I mean, you had gone to Jamaica. You had come back with...
Well, that's it.
That's not
it.
A small thing. Did you find your groove in Jamaica?
But the thing is, this is the way I wrote the novel.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote the novel before Jonathan even got off the plane to come to California. Mm-hmm. That book was finished. It was a fantasy. Okay, before he moved to California, a lot of people don't understand that, mm-hmm. and it was a novel. People don't understand that novels are, some of them are grounded in real life situations, but you exaggerate everything. Believe me.
But once you're so identified with the stories that are in your book, it must make that sort of working through the aftermath of a breakup like this.
Tough. I don't care.
Really?
If people think. I don't know what you're saying. Maybe I'm missing something.
Just that book is superimposed on your life very regularly, and now here you are living through the breakup of the very relationship that people see as having been born and described there. So whether it's directly autobiographical or not, it's kind of a signboard that you carry. I wrote the story, and now there goes the fantasy relationship.
Okay. That's okay.
When you write,
that's okay. I mean, if people think it's okay, I mean, yeah. I'm not embarrassed about it.
Yeah,
I'm really not.
We hear it. We hear it. When you write close to home, you live with it too. Novelist Terry McMillan, hang on. There's a lot more we want to hear here. A lot of callers want to join us. You're welcome to join us. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Mr. Lover. 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 Mr
right, yeah.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital, for more than 60 years helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services in Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist Terry McMillan, author of Waiting to Exhale, How Stella Got Her Groove Back, and her new novel, The Interruption of Everything. You can join us. Did you get your groove back with Terry McMillan's Stella? And what's the groove you would like novelist McMillan to work now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Karen is calling from Waverly, Iowa. Hi, Karen. You're on the air.
Hi, and thanks for the program. The topic is great. I just have to say that, first, I don't think it's about black or white. I'm perimenopausal. I've been in a relationship for 3 years that just ended. The guy is going through a crisis, and it's not about that. The first thing that people will tell you, and this relates to how we get our ideas from history, what our historic role has been, and also from the media, from today's television programs and stuff, the first thing I got told was, well, there's someone out there for you. I agree totally. Are you trying to hang on to a marriage, or are you trying to hang on to somebody because everyone else thinks you need one?
Karen, let me ask you, have you taken solace from Terry McMillan's books in the past? Are you looking to read it as a field guide to how to survive this passage?
No, actually, I'm surviving just fine because I'm getting better with every breath that I take. And that is the end of the next novel. I'm getting better with every breath that I take.
Inhale and exhale. Terry McMillan, speak to Karen here and what you hear, her circumstance.
Well, it just sounds like she knows what's going on. And I think she's allowed herself to just move forward and, throw off her losses.
But is that?
I mean, seriously, that's what it sounds like. She sounds very healthy to me.
Yeah, she's feisty. She's standing right up there, and she's right in the window of life that you're writing about, in The Interruption of Everything. Is that chasm out there for everybody to fall into? Is that your experience of going through this age? Do you see everybody falling off the beam one way or another?
Well, I think that a lot of women are much more conscientious because we can't avoid it. Going through menopause is it's a physiological and emotional and psychological experience, and it doesn't just happen overnight. I think that you can't avoid it. Men sometimes are unaware of when they're going through a midlife crisis. Sometimes I don't think that they are as cognizant of it, but we do, and a lot of women, I think, have an either-or attitude. There are a lot of women out here that see it as a downhill spiral, that, it's a lot of women that get depressed as a result of going through menopause, and they see it as a loss. Mm. And I find that unfortunate. Then you have other women who are recharged. I'm one of those. And see life as a bowl of cherries, for lack of a better cliche.
Because what are you going to do? What are you going to do otherwise? Yeah. Let's get another call here. Bala's calling from Cedar Falls, Iowa. Iowa's on the phone.
What's going
today
on in Iowa?
I knew it's hot out there. Hi, Bala.
Yeah, we're a bunch of early risers, I guess. Good morning.
Yeah.
My question is about, I'm an aspiring writer, and I've heard a lot of writers talk about how they fall in love with their characters. And I'm wondering, are you ever tempted to revisit some of the really dynamic characters that you've had in your previous books? And if so, how do you resist that? Or if not, why is that you're not tempted to do so?
Mm, great question. Is Mama coming back? Is Stella coming back? What do you say,
no,
to her?
No. When I'm writing about these characters, I am sort of consumed by them. And I live their experiences when I'm writing it. But when I'm finished, I'm a different person. And I have learned something. Something in me has changed as a result of the experience that I've had by being these people. I don't think that life you get to a point where everything is figured out and everything is smooth forever. But I like to stop with my characters when they are in a position at least where I think they're strong enough to, or at least hopefully equipped, better equipped to deal with future problems. And that's, to me, good enough. That's where I want to leave them.
And when you're done with that, you move on. Bala, thanks for your call.
Yeah, because the thing is this, we just keep...
It's your changing.
I mean, life is a series of knots, we just, how we unravel them determines the quality of our life. And I can just keep revisiting and revisiting. It's never going to be perfect.
But there's new knots
out there. So I'd rather find
new
people.
Yep. Let's get another call. Ron is calling from Bridgewater, Massachusetts. Hi, Ron. You're on the air.
Hi, Ron. What's up, Terry?
Hi.
I just wanted to know, what is your opinion on some of the other African-American authors like Chester Hines, Donald Goins, Terry Woods, people like that? And I'll hang up for the answer.
Ron, thanks for calling.
And what did you say?
Donald Goins, Terry Woods.
I don't know who Terry Woods is.
Ron, do we still
have... Yeah.
You're talking about an older generation of black writers here?
Well, Donald Goins from the 70s.
I know who Donald Goins is.
Yeah.
And Chester Himes.
Yeah, exactly. I just wanted to know, what is your opinion on some of those African-American authors?
Well, first of all, I think they're classics, and we need them. I think all the work that the bodies of work that black writers that we have written is all important because it all captures it's anthropology and it's history. It captures where we were, when we were there, why and how. And I think everything has its place in time, and I'm grateful to them. I mean, I still read some of Chester Himes' Crisis. I think that a lot of our work it's evolutionary. It shows where we've been and where we've come from and how we evolve. So I find it all very, very valuable. I really do.
Terry McMillan, you've been described as having the soul of a great social novelist. Where are you in terms of reaching your aspiration in terms of what you'd like your work, your books to do? Have you clinched it? Are you still on the road?
No, I'm still on the road because, again, I don't think there is an apex. There's no one place where you arrive where you should ever be just completely satisfied. And, you know, writing is it's a way to investigate and explore our behavior. And it's just a curiosity that I have, and I think all writers have it. And I don't think there's a point where you stop being curious or where you feel like you have all the answers or you understand everything. And I think that's why writers don't retire.
We just got a minute and a half left. That relationship in Jamaica was the kernel of a big book for you. Now it's breaking up. Will the breakup be the kernel of a book?
No. No. You mean a novel?
Yes.
No. Uh-uh. I can tell you that right now. No.
Too
but
painful, not
thousand,
illuminating?
No, the thing is this, I have about 1,000 pages I've written just about betrayal and about trust. And it's much larger than Jonathan and myself. It's how valuable is the human heart and how much is it worth? And why don't people accept responsibility for their actions? And especially when they know that their behavior and by withholding information, lying, how they justify it, and when they don't accept responsibility for what they do, and how people just discard other people's feelings and the human heart as if it is replaceable or as if it can be replenished. I don't get it.
Terry McMillan, it sounds like you've got enough material for a lot more work. We'll be looking forward to it. The latest book is The Interruption of Everything. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, remembering the slain freelance journalist, Stephen Vincent. This is On Point. Former New York art critic Stephen Vincent was in his Greenwich Village apartment on 9/11. He watched the towers fall. I knew right away my country was at war, he later said. I'm too old to enlist, so I thought I would use my writing talents. The art critic turned to blogging and his own investigative journalism. He followed his close friend, the painter Steve Mumford, to Iraq. On July 31st, in a New York Times op-ed piece, Vincent wrote that the police in the southern Iraqi city of Basra had been infiltrated by Shiite militants who were carrying out assassinations. 2 days later, Stephen Vincent was hauled into a pickup truck and shot dead, his body found on a Basra street. His translator, an Iraqi woman named Layla, was also shot. She remains in critical condition. In this radio diary, artist Steve Mumford remembers Stephen Vincent. We begin with a reading from Vincent's last blog post, dated July 26th, where he describes a meeting he and his translator Layla had with an American Air Force captain in a military bar in Basra.
Stepping into a crowded, sunny, air-conditioned room, we found the usual atmosphere. Rap music, a large screen TV playing a video of half-naked women cavorting around a fat, unattractive man. The smell of beer and cigarette smoke. The only difference, of course, was Layla. Her pink headscarf standing out among the Guinness pints and 16-ounce buds like a WTU banner in a frat house. This was, I realized with a mild start, her first ever visit to that symbol of Western corruption, a saloon.
Well, Steve was always this really peripatetic kind of guy. I'd say there were probably 10 different evolutions going on in his personality and understanding of the Middle East as he was there. In Iraq, Steve saw this the possibility of having a real political freedom in a place which had never known anything close to it. Especially in Basra, where he spent the last 6 months, this possibility seemed to be slipping through the fingers of everybody that lived there. This was something that he just couldn't stand. He felt he had to alert the world to what was going on in Basra. That might paint kind of an impression of somebody that was naive, which Steve certainly was not. His whole endeavor was very, very personal. He was there because he was so passionately and personally invested in both the future of the Iraqis and the future of Western democracy and the U.S.'s role in it.
I'd wanted to introduce Layla to the Gary Cooper side of America and felt I'd succeeded. Instead of the evasive, oversubtle, windy Iraqi fond of theory and abstraction, here was a to-the-point Yank, rolling up his sleeves with a can-do spirit of fair play and doing good. "I want to have a positive effect on this country's future," the captain said. "For example, whenever I learn of a contracting firm run by women, I put it at the top of my list for businesses I want to consider for future projects." Layla, however, flashed a tight, cynical smile. "How do you know," she began, "that the religious parties haven't put a woman's name on a company letterhead to win a bid? Maybe you are just funneling money to extremists posing as contractors." The captain looked confused. "Religious parties? Extremists? Oh, boy." Not for the first time, I felt I was living in a Graham Greene novel. This one about a U.S. soldier, call it the naive American, who finds what works so well in PowerPoint presentations has unpredictable results when applied to the realities of Iraq. Or is that the story of our whole attempt to liberate this nation?
Yeah, you know, I do think that there is a lot of connection with Steve between his love and fascination of the art world and then kind of plunging into Iraqi politics. I think one thing that motivated Steve was looking for a kind of transcendence. I think that he looked to art for some kind of transcendence. And the other thing that was an absolute a passion to the point of being an obsession for him was the whole notion of freedom. You know, Steve's opinions were powerful because they couldn't be easily pegged to what we expect to hear from the left or the right. He was really speaking from the heart. And he was really uninterested in arguments that evoked cultural relativism.
Collecting himself, the captain countered, "But should we really get involved in choosing one political group over another? I mean, I've always believed that we shouldn't project American values onto other cultures. Who is to say we are right and they are wrong?" And there it was, the familiar cultural values are relative argument, surprising though it was to hear it from a military man. But that, too, I realized, was part of American naivete, the belief that our values are no better, and usually worse, than those of foreign nations, that we have no right to judge the other, and that imposing our way of life on the world is the sure path to the bleak morality of empire. But Layla would have none of it. "No, believe me," she exclaimed, sitting forward on her stool. "These religious parties are wrong. Why shouldn't you apply your own cultural values?" It was a moment I wish every muddle-headed college kid and Western civilization-hating leftist could have witnessed. An Air Force captain quoting chapter and verse from the New American Gospel of Multiculturalism, only to have a flesh and blood representative of the other declare that he was incorrect, that discriminations and judgment between cultures are possible, necessary, especially when it comes to the absolutely unacceptable way Middle Eastern Arabs treat women.
I couldn't believe it. I was completely stunned. I kind of sat with that for a while, and it began to penetrate. I realized how much I was not only going to miss him, but how much I felt like I wouldn't have his voice in my life anymore, and the life of this country for that matter. He knew the risks. He knew there was a possibility that he'd be killed. But he had to go back because it was his overriding passion to provide a really strong voice against the forces of fundamentalism that were bent on taking away the rights that Iraqis were just starting to claim.
A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds, Emerson reminds us. And if he'd lived in Basra, he'd have added the jinn of Islamic extremists as well. Yours, from the land of the no-show employee, backdoor payout, paper corporation, and unbalanced books, Stephen.
Freelance journalist Stephen Vincent was found dead of bullet wounds in Basra on August 2nd. His friend Steve Mumford is author of the forthcoming Baghdad Journal, an artist in occupied Iraq. Vincent's last blog post was read by Sean Cole. You can read more of Stephen Vincent's work at our website, onpointradio.org. And today, we say goodbye to longtime On Point producer and director John Roberts. He's not the Supreme Court nominee. He might be one day. Our John Roberts is headed off to law school. Since On Point's birth in the harrowing days after 9/11, John has been a rock and a friend to all of us, an inspiration and guide. It's been an amazing journey. John will always be family here. We wish him more than well. We wish him joy. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Matt Lieber, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, Christina Russo, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman. With help from John Berger, Angel Cozzelli, and Persephone Meal. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.